Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking about exercise, in particular, a book entitled Fast After 50, which demolishes the aging myth. You can get faster. You can get better. You are not consigned to an inevitable decline, according to the author, whose legendary coach, Joe Friel, author of Fast After 50. And also, he's written, along with Dr. Lauren Cordain, The Paleo Diet for Athletes. So let's talk a little bit about diet for athletes. That's very, very important, especially these very long events. You know, it's one thing if you're going to do like maybe a 440 run or something like that. Okay, you know, sports nutrition, yeah, sort of important. You want to keep lean and mean. But what about these really long endurance events? The carbo-loading paradigm, is that passé?
Well, let's talk about it this way. I think it depends largely on what type of event we're talking about. Some events are, let's take, for example, road racing, bicycle road racing, the Tour de France, which is what most people are aware of, that type of racing. In that kind of a race, the endurance is very critical to the outcome of the race. It's going to be typically a 4 or 5 hour race. So endurance is extremely important. And also associated with that, in that type of race, is very, very high intensity, because in bike racing, the outcomes of the race are typically determined in something that takes less than 2 minutes, very, very brief segments where somebody, there's a breakaway on a hill or into a crosswind or something changes. Consequently, there's a breakaway, and the final selection for the podium is determined by who's in that break. Those type of events are unique. There's not very many of those type of events. Most endurance events are very, very steady states, such as running an ultra marathon, you know, running a race that may take 8 or more hours. That's very steady
or
state.
A standard Ironman competition, which is slow and steady wins the race. I mean, there's not a lot of sprinting in that.
Yes. And so the answer we don't have to this question in terms of what science tells us is what does diet glycogen content in the muscle, for example, especially, what does that have to do with performance in those type of events? We know from research and also from ultramarathon runners that eating a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet is very effective. There's been lots of studies that shown that that helps the athlete to maintain a good steady pace for many hours without worrying about taking in lots and lots of food, which is one of the problems that Ironman triathletes especially have, is they can very easily have their what's called a gut shutdown. They become nauseous and have a hard time processing anything in their stomachs because they've got to get so many calories in to keep up with the demands the body's placing on the system, especially for more sugar. More glycogen. And so I think in those type of events where the intensity is rather on the low side, eating a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet is quite beneficial. I highly recommend it to athletes to give that a try if they haven't done so already. The other side of the coin, though, it has to do with these very long events that also have lots of intensity thrown in throughout them. Those sorts of races, we really don't have either experience or research to answer the question of what's more beneficial for that type of athlete. So we're kind of shooting in the dark when, as soon as we get beyond long steady state type events. So if it's long steady state, I'm a big proponent of eating a low carbohydrate or paleo diet, especially emphasizing the fat in the diet. But if it's longer than that, I really can't be quite as assured that it's going to help the athletes. I really don't know the answer to that question yet.
Well, there's a little physiology involved, and this is controversial, but there's this notion that glycogen is the storage form of sugar, which is the main fuel for the body, and it gets stored in the muscles, and it gets stored in the liver. So can a diet that's primarily protein and fat load up the glycogen depots in the muscle and in the liver adequately? I mean, that was the rationale for these carbo-loading pasta parties that they have before the marathon, which may have been misguided because turns out maybe that wasn't necessary.
Yeah, I would argue that carbohydrate or glycogen is not the primary fuel the body wants to turn to. It really wants to turn to fat. That's really what our ancestors thrived on, was the fat in their diets, and that's what drove their long endurance contest, if you will, which is a hunting session. Their hunting sessions would last typically 3 to 5 hours every other day or so, and during this time, their body was using fat for fuel. We were actually designed to burn fat for fuel. That's our primary source. Glycogen is just there to do things that are very quick, short bursts of energy. Like if we finally track the animal we're trying to catch, we've got it fatigued, but it bursts away and tries to run, and we take off after it real fast. That's where the glycogen kicks in. So I would say that it's really fat that our body likes to burn. So I suspect that's what works best for long endurance athletes. The paleo concept is basically the concept that we should be eating a diet similar to what our ancestors ate more than 10,000 years ago, which was the Paleolithic period in human history. So that's the whole concept behind it, is that we burn fat for fuel primarily, and so we don't really use carbohydrate all that much. And in fact, for those people, carbohydrate was very, very difficult to find, especially north of 40 degrees latitude, north or south of 40 degrees latitude in the winter months. What would you eat that would be carbohydrate when there's 6 inches of snow on the ground and you're in northern Europe?
Yeah. I mean, from the standpoint of evolution, that makes sense.
Yeah. So the whole thing is just it's a concept of eating that is a little different for most people. Most people don't really have a grasp of what would happen 10,000 years ago. It's kind of like we're doing now, what everybody's always done. And so you have to kind of dig into evolution. And beyond that also, how humans over the last 2.5 million years how they've eaten and how they've moved, what we would call exercise, or they didn't consider it exercise, but it was simply the way they earned a living, which was to hunt animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it seems that humans really are built for endurance. I mean, we're not faster than many other animals, but we have the ability to track for very long distances, and ultimately the animals that are faster tire out, and then we end up capturing them.
Exactly right. In fact, that's the theory about why humans survive, why we're still around as a species, is because we were the best animals on the planet for endurance. We're one of the slowest animals on the planet. You can take the fastest human, Usain Bolt, for example, and put him up against almost any other animal you want, and that animal is faster than Usain Bolt is. We're very, very slow when it comes to speed, but when it comes to endurance, we are the best, and it's primarily because we sweat, which is an interesting thing about it. If it wasn't for our sweat, our endurance would not be nearly so good. Hmm. Most animals don't sweat. There are very few animals that sweat. Horses sweat, and I've forgotten, there's another animal, like a giraffe, perhaps. There's something else out there that sweats besides horses.
It's our air conditioning system that's superior.
Exactly right. So because of our sweating, we were able to put up with hunting during the heat of the day in equatorial Africa. And because of that, we could run down over time, over the course of several hours, almost any animal we wanted to catch, even though a deer or whatever the animal may be is much faster than us. We could run it in submission because it couldn't put up with the heat nearly as well as we could. So it's a long story about how we came to be the way we are, but it really comes down to that we're just really excellent endurance athletes.
You know, I'll share with you that I see athletes in consultation, you know, I'm a medical nutritionist, and I see them making the same mistake over and over, is they believe that they're like cars and that they need fuel to fuel their exertions. And so typically I used to be in a bike club, and we would arrive at the finish after, you know, 30 or 50 mile bike ride, and there would be a picnic table laid out there with sticky buns and, you know, orange juice and fresh fruit and, you know, juice. And, you know, after the race, you know, everybody just descended on it and consumed all that stuff. Is that an appropriate way to replenish yourself after exertion? Is there a need to do that, or is that a mistake?
If the athlete is eating a high-fat diet, a paleo diet, that's a mistake. If the athlete is eating a high carbohydrate diet, which by itself is a mistake, I believe, for most athletes, for most people, in fact, then they have to do that because they've got to replenish those carbohydrate sources, which are the only source of fuel they really have. They have a hard time accessing fat because they've trained their body to burn sugar for fuel. So they've got to get more sugar in. That's the downside of relying on glycogen as your primary fuel source, is you've got to keep replenishing it constantly. You don't have very much glycogen on board, maybe 2,000 calories top end. But fat, we've got enough fat on board. The skinniest athlete can go for days and days if they are can access their fat stores. So I'm afraid most people have really taught their bodies to ignore fat and to go primarily to sugar, so they've got to keep that sugar coming in all the time to maintain any kind of exercise regimen at all.
I think it sounds like what you're describing is that people are a little bit like hybrid cars. They can operate either on gasoline or electricity. Then the analogy would be it's either carbohydrates or fat. But once you get stuck on one, it's kind of hard to access the other. Is that a fair analogy?
That's true. When you in sugar for fuel, which is quite easy to do, you can spend just a couple of few days and you'd be fully adapted to burning sugar for fuel. You've got to keep that sugar coming in whatever form you can find it. The most common form is starches. Breads, potatoes, cereals.
So, Coach Friel, in your book, you talk about the issue of body fat. And, hey, you know, one of the rationales for exercising is to look good naked, right? I mean, come on. There's a lot of health benefits, but there are some aesthetic benefits, and that's what a lot of people are after. So as we age, we accumulate body fat. There's just no question about it. Even some of the top athletes, they have a little bit of a jelly roll around the midsection, even if they have great endurance. Is that inevitable, or can we stave that off with high-intensity exercise?
Yeah, I write about that in the book. It's really a hormonal issue. As we get older, things change hormone-wise in our bodies. And when we were young, our bodies were brimming over with all kinds of hormones that were very effective for keeping us skinny, essentially. And as we get older, those hormones aren't nearly as numerous as they were when we were young. Consequently, we tend to put on body fat, especially around the belly and the hips, which is where people over the age of 50 tend to put it on. That's because of a hormone called lipoprotein lipase, LPL, which interacts with insulin to store fat. That's its only job. And it's kept at bay when you're young because of testosterone, which keeps LPL from being as effective as it is when you get older. And yet, when you age, of course, we don't produce as much testosterone. Therefore, the LPL has nothing to keep it from storing fat. Or less to keep it from storing fat. And so consequently, we put on this belly fat as we get older, and we see that in people all the time, including athletes also sometimes.
And is that a feature of improper diet? Is it possible that if we don't carbo-load or fuel our exertions with too much sugar and refined carbohydrates or starches, that we can offset that tendency?
Some people are carbohydrate resistant, or insulin resistant is a more common term used for this. And that simply means that they put on body weight very, very easily when they eat carbohydrate, and they have a hard time losing weight. In fact, can't lose weight at all usually because their body is so resistant to carbohydrate. Those they really need to cut back on carbohydrate. That's the main issue. When I see a fat person on the street, I could probably have them within 2 months being quite lean if I could just change their diet, get them to quit eating so much carbohydrate and eat more fat. They would trim that body fat off real fast. They'd become much leaner people than what they are now. And I see that with athletes also. I run into athletes occasionally who are training for an Ironman distance triathlon, and yet they're carrying around a big old belly with right. fat rolls.
So you concede that it's possible that even with the tremendous training and exertion that's required to prepare oneself for the Ironman, remember, 2.4-mile swim and a 112-mile bike ride and followed by a full marathon, that it's possible for wrong eating to subvert the effects of intensive exercise.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I go to races all the time, And I see people who are sometimes obese, more commonly just greatly overweight, doing Ironman distance races, right, or any distance
we call them the Clydesdale division or the Athena division. It's for, you know, heavier weight individuals participating in those races, a special category. And I see that too, and it surprises me because these people exercise a ton, and they're great athletes. They have really good endurance, but something about their metabolism or their diet is preventing them from achieving leanness. Okay,
I agree. Yes, that's true.
Okay, so finally, and you know, we're talking about exercise and, you know, all the different, you know, knock yourself out and, you know, push, but you actually give accord great importance to rest and recovery. And that's an element that for some individuals, or maybe a little bit too obsessed, shall we say, is missing from their training regimen. So does that change after you're 50? Are the requirements for rest and recovery different than in younger athletes?
Yes, it is for most all athletes. In fact, I would say for all athletes. Eventually what happens as we get older is our body just does not recover as fast as it did when we were young. And this, again, goes back to hormones and a few other things too. But we just don't have the stuff on board to help us recover. When an athlete is very young, in their 20s, they can essentially do anything they want, and they're going to recover very quickly. And when I was in college as a runner, I used to stay up half the night or sometimes all night studying, and still the next day have a track meet I was running in and be quite all right for it. It really wasn't a problem to do that. I could eat junk, and I could get away with it. The older you get, the more sensitive your body comes to all of these things, and especially to the need for sleep and rest. And in fact, one of the things that there's actually some great benefits that occur while we sleep that people aren't aware of. One of those benefits is that that's when we release most of our hormones into our body, and that's when all this rebuilding takes place. So if you've done a hard workout but you don't get adequate sleep afterwards, and this goes on for several days like that, you're just not going to reap the benefits that you would have got sleep throughout that same period of time. So sleep is critical to performance.
Indeed. Or should there be off days? How many off days should an athlete over 50 take, or does it depend?
It depends on the athlete. I just rode the other day with an athlete who is about my age, and he was saying what he's discovered as he's gotten older is he can't ride 7 days a week. He has to ride, take one day off every week to make sure he gets recovered, consequently, or otherwise he would wind up unable to have quality sessions. So it's unique for every individual how often or if they even have days off from training. It's one of those sort of things that you have to kind of find out by trial and error.
Right. It's highly individual. And, it really is a science to teach athletes to become aware of their bodies and to monitor their bodies effectively so that they know when they're getting into the red zone of overtraining. What are the signs of overtraining syndrome? How does someone know that they're overdoing it?
Yeah, most athletes never see overtraining. They think they do. What they're experiencing is called overreaching, which is meaning they're pushing themselves quite hard. The difference between overreaching and overtraining is that overtraining doesn't go away with several days of rest. It still lingers there. It's kind of like a bad disease. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of thing that the athlete doesn't really appreciate how bad it is. It's like having Lyme disease, which is caused by ticks. The symptoms are very similar, and that can last for years. Mm-hmm. Similar things happen with athletes. I once coached an athlete, a pro triathlete, who had gotten himself overtrained before I started coaching him. In fact, that's why he asked me to coach him. And he only lasted about 2 years beyond his overtraining episode because he could never get back to where he was before it happened. He was a relatively young athlete who was one of the best triathletes in the world at the time. And one single bout of overtraining where he decided not to take any rest at all and just push himself as hard as he could for week after week after week resulted in the end of his career. So most people never experience it. Most people experience overreaching, but they take a couple of days, 1 or 2 days of recovery, and they're fine. They're back to training again. After 1 or 2 days of rest or really easy exercise, you're not recovered, then you're overtrained. But it takes a great deal of fortitude to push yourself to that level because your body rebels. Mm-hmm. You don't want to get out of bed in the morning when you're overtrained. And so consequently, it's hard to do, but people still are able to pull it off sometimes.
Okay, so there's natural physiologic checks and balances to that usually. So what's today's intelligent medicine call to action in conclusion? You know, what are some of the resources that people can access? You've got a website, which is joefriel.com, correct?
Actually, it's joefrielsblog.com.
Okay, joefrielsblog.com. And also, your many books can be found on Amazon, but I recommend very highly Fast After 50. We'll put up a link at our website. You offer training, personal training, and you offer training seminars to sports organizations, and you lecture as well, correct?
I lecture quite a bit. I really don't coach athletes anymore. I now coach coaches. Mm-hmm. And so I do lots of training for coaches, also seminars for coaches on how to what I've learned over the years about coaching and through experience in science. So I do a lot of those, but I really don't do any hands-on coaching of athletes anymore.
Okay, so you no longer can get Joe Friel as your own personal trainer. He's training the trainers at a higher level, and that gets the word out to even more people. Thank you very much for joining us. And, you know, once again, I want to extend my personal appreciation to you for inspiring me and informing me about, you know, the ways to strive for personal best and to efficiently train to meet your own personal training goal. It's really, you know, you really have done pioneering work in that regard. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Ron.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.